right. So here we are, Inform Podcast. I think this is episode number 36, if I'm not mistaken. I might be wrong, but I think it's 36. I am here, as I always am, with the cat's meow of the podcasting world. Jared, how you doing?
Some days I'm feeling more like a bobcat cat's meow. Today I'm feeling more like a house cat cat's meow. So I don't know what that means, but it's how I'm feeling today.
House cats are still vicious predators. Don't forget that.
Very true.
And as people can hear here, we have a third voice on the podcast today. I was trying to think of how I was going to introduce you, and this is what I've decided to go with. We are joined with the Dwayne Rock Johnson of the podcasting world, Adam, Comrade Adam from Red Library. How you doing?
Good. I'm doing very well. I'm glad to be here. I'm about to perform the theoretical razor's edge on everything we're about to talk about. I used to be a big wrestling fan when I was a kid.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's because you have taste, right? You know what I mean? Like, that's how
that
works.
Yeah, obviously.
So, all right.
We're like 30 seconds in. You're already firing shots, Neil, because I did not care about wrestling when I was a kid.
Ooh, called out.
See, there's no accounting for taste, Jared. But here's the way it works, right? Like, you gotta, this is some life coaching, I guess, that I'm going to give people for free here. Here's what everybody should do. All right. You should have a copy of something like The Phenomenology of Spirit, you know, sitting on your coffee table because you're highbrow, and you should you know, read it during breaks while you do things like watch wrestling, because you're also lowbrow.
Yeah.
This is how you live.
You gotta negate the negation. That's the idea.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of when I was getting my doctorate, and I was in like the sort of like research sequence of that, where we had to learn a lot about stats and statistical tests. And so I had a lot of stats homework that I needed to do in this program called SPSS and sometimes in Excel or whatever. And I hated this class. I hated this, right? This is not the kind of thing that I like doing at all, but it was a necessary component of getting the degree that I got. So I did it. And the only way that I could really do stats homework was if I was and not want to drink bleach and turpentine, was if I was watching hockey at the same time.
I love it.
Yeah. Anyways, all of this is not what we're here to talk about today. Imagine that. What we're going to be talking about today is we're going to be doing the third part in the Inform series on psychoanalysis, politics, and Discord servers. And Jared and I we have mentioned in the previous two installments of this that we're both people who are on the Discord server for Red Library, which is the podcast that Adam hosts. Adam, why don't you talk a little bit about Red Library real quick here? Tell people about the podcast, just in case. I mean, many of our listeners I know also do listen to your podcast, but let's assume that we have a few who don't. Why don't you introduce it to them and tell them what they might hear if they were to, you know, add that to their listening list?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and just in case y'all haven't mentioned it as well, you both are, you know, past guests of our show, ongoing guests. You know, the From 78 podcast is part of the Lost Horizons network with us in the Regrettable Century. So there's a lot of links, even if we haven't specifically crossed paths on Inform yet. But Red Library Political Education Podcast for Today's Left has been around for a little over a year and a half. It's a podcast focused on reading and trying to teach books through the format of, you know, sort of very, I think, in-depth and like theoretically heavy conversations, but with a lot of humor and trying to make things accessible. The idea is that we want to read books that are very relevant for engaging in left politics today that typically you don't read or encounter in a lot of other like podcasts or in organizing work and in study groups. And so we want to take those books, try to make them accessible and fun and relevant through sort of teaching them to each other, talking about them, you know, making a lot of references to memes and kind of, you know, shit posting along the way. So that's kind of what we do. We do cover a lot of things related to psychoanalysis. You know, I'm an LCSW. I'm a therapist. I've been studying psychoanalysis for quite some time. And Alex, who's another mainstay on our show, is very steeped in Zizek and Lacan. And so we're trying to really also incorporate a lot of psychoanalytic perspectives into how we think about politics.
Yeah, it's a really wonderful show. Anybody who doesn't listen to Red Library, I would encourage you in the strongest possible terms to check it out. Because if you like what we're doing here on Inform, I really think that you'll like what they're doing on Red Library as well. So having said that, let's kind of jump in here. The mm-hmm. kind of plan of attack that I have here is we've been having this ongoing conversation on the Red Library Discord server about psychoanalysis and the ways in which psychoanalysis either can be or can't be used, you know, I think for political purposes. That would be my most general description of what the conversation has been.
Yeah.
And people have been asking some really great questions. They've been making some really great comments. And I feel like when I'm engaging on the Discord server itself, you know, it's time shifted. Sometimes something comes through, but I can't answer right then because I have stuff to do. It's text-based, so a lot of like nuances really can't come out in the same way that when we talk like this, the way that they can come out. And so I figured what we'd do here is maybe start with Jared, then move into Adam. And why don't each of you kind of like bring up one of the topics that you think is important, you know, from this conversation. And we'll just kind of see what happens when we do that. I have one thing that I want to bring up too, but I figured I'd go last and we'd start with Jared, move to Adam, then go to me. So how's that sound?
Sure.
All right, Jared, take it away, man. What do you got?
All right, cool. So one of the leftover things that I had was actually from something that you wrote in the Discord server, Adam, about I'll try to summarize the quote a little bit because otherwise it'll take me a minute to get through it. So basically, I think what you're saying in this quote that I'm talking about is about the sort of economy of jouissance and when too much of it gets invested in imaginary identification. And like, I think what you're asking is how and where you draw a line between the amount of investment being given into an imaginary identification versus how and where you draw it for like a more useful purposes of investing jouissance in an identity. I think what you're talking about specifically is that like it's both necessary to have identifications, but also potentially dangerous. I think is what you're getting into and asking about in that question.
Yeah, and the reason why I wanted to sort of have us talk through this and kind of explore it more with y'all is because listening to the first two episodes you did, my impression or kind of my takeaway was in terms of what psychoanalysis, particularly Lacanian analysis, can offer to kind of political engagement in left politics is a kind of check on the way that jouissance, you know, sort of spiderwebs its way through or like permeates the way that things like how we include and or exclude people within leftist organizing spaces, like who's a part of the quote unquote revolution and who's not. And it seemed to me from some of our other discussions that a lot of this hinges on the way that you all interpret Lacan and think about the place of imaginary identification. And so I got the sense that a lot of it was about like being able to check that and to like push people to be able to recognize how there is this sort of dangerous, risky element of investing too much in those identifications, the way that jouissance permeates them without us being aware of it. My perspective, and I'll kind of say more about this whenever I do my turn, but it seems to me that we can't necessarily, you know, completely get out of imaginary identification and the role of the specular image in how we identify. But it does seem like this is kind of a lot of maybe where, some criticisms of things that we call like identity politics come from. It's the way that people get very invested in those identifications.
That makes sense to me. You know, I think you've read this before, so I like you'll be familiar with what I'm talking about. So the reason that imaginary identification has been on my mind so much, and I think this is true for Neil as well, is because we're reading this piece by Jacques-Alain Miller called The Turin Theory of the School. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure you said that you've read it before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about putting a check on the jouissance of imaginary identification, that's what I'm thinking of like every time that you say it. Like, I'll try to really briefly summarize this for anybody listening because there's a ton of stuff in this thing that I'm talking about. But basically the idea of it is that you can be invested in an identification in some sort of group. Specifically, Miller is talking about a school. But you can also like cut away the investment of being inside of a group. You can do both of these things. So as you say what you're saying, Adam, the way that I think about this is that the two things sort of exist in a dialectic with one another. Like if you can belong to a group, you have to belong to a group before you can be separated from it in the first place.
Absolutely.
You have to have the one before you can have the other. Mm-hmm. That's what comes to mind when you said all the things that you just did.
Yeah.
As you guys are talking about this, what comes to my mind here is one, the thing that Jared just referenced, right? The Jacques-Alain Miller's piece, The Turin Theory of the Subject of the School, which I think is a really important thing for people to read if they're interested in how psychoanalysis can be used in a really broad kind of like social context, right? Taking it out of the clinic and bringing it into the streets. I think that's what would be a really important text if that's something that you're interested in. It's not an easy text to read, I don't think. I think you have to work at it. You probably have to read other things that will help you understand it at the necessary level of depth, ultimately, right? One of the other things that you would need to read would be the Freudian text, the group analysis, or group psychology and the analysis of the ego. That's another thing. Because in that text, Freud, and this came up on the Discord server kind of recently mm-hmm. too.
Yeah, we might actually do a reading group on it because of this. So
yeah, I mean, it's a very important text. It's a good idea, I think, to read that. And then maybe afterwards, if you have the time and the energy, go to Civilization and Its Discontents. Mm-hmm. The problem, I think, and this is a personal preference that I guess that I'm voicing here, a lot of people who are interested in Freud do read Civilization and Its Discontents for I don't know what reason exactly. Maybe it's got a sexier title or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it seems like that's one of the things that people, if they're interested in Freud, they kind of have read that. And it mm-hmm. seems to me like less people have read Group Psychology and the Analysis of the Ego.
I would agree.
And I think that those are two texts that are very close together. They supplement each other.
Yeah.
And you can read Civilization and Its Discontents first. I don't think it really matters what order in which you read them, but it is important to read them both. And I would actually even also add Totem and Taboo into that mm-hmm. that mix too, as like the kind of like third leg of that three-leg stool, right? You get those three texts, you read them, you understand them. You're going to have a pretty good idea of the way in which Freud kind of uses psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic thinking and concepts as a way to engage with much larger social phenomena that are taking place with large groups of people in the world. Mm-hmm. And there's also clinical implications that you can take what you read in those books or essays, whatever you want to call them, bring them into the clinic as well. But they're primarily, I think, used for this like broader scale kind of psychoanalytic thought. In group analysis, one of the things that Freud is writing about is this thing called group effects. And he talks about the fact that when we're part of a group, we will act in ways that are different than the way we would act if we were isolated, if we were on our own. We can see this, for example, in really big phenomenon like riots. If there's a riot, you have a large group of people that are breaking laws usually. If there was just one person alone in the streets on like a Tuesday afternoon, they probably wouldn't do the same kind of things they would do if they were with a large group of people engaging in a riot on like a Friday night or whatever night, really. The group essentially frees us up and kind of takes the brakes off of the jouissance. And when the brakes are taken off, people do things that under other circumstances, they would be much more apprehensive to do. The same thing can happen with not only with things like riots, but just with like the things that we say, the things that we think, and the enjoyment that we get from saying them and thinking them when we're in a group. And this is one of the things that I would say is really important for all people to really try to keep in mind. But since I'm somebody who, you know, politically engages on the left and considers himself to be on the left, I'm more interested in the ways in which the left might become sort of like victims of these group effects, the ways in which the left kind of starts to enjoy things a little bit too much, and in enjoying them a little bit too much, starts to do things that, in my mind, are not congruent with the project of the left in the broadest possible way. So that's what I'm thinking about it. I'll stop talking here and see what other people think.
Do you mind if I actually respond to that a little bit? Because I think this is actually the very last thing that I had in my notes that I wanted to talk about was specifically about group psychology and Alain Miller's idea of the school. So let me think of how to get into this, because this is a huge topic. And I think Word. It's actually a really preeminent one to think about the role of psychoanalysis and the way we interpret psychoanalysis for any kind of political engagement. So let me start with this. Do you all see that for maybe the school of interpretation out of Alain Miller, that it's almost as if the necessary kind of almost like conclusion about what taking psychoanalysis out of the clinic is his idea of the school and the way that the school functions? Like it's very particularly not saying, you know, go join a movement, right? Or go join like a revolutionary organization or even a conservative organization. It's very much about the school.
I think so. It's an interesting question. And I think that part of what Miller is getting at is that he's saying that, that the school, when he uses that signifier, that term, mm-hmm. what he's attempting to describe is something which is different than a political party. It's mm-hmm. something which is different than a labor union. It's something which is different yeah. than a university. And I guess maybe some context would be potentially interesting with this. So this is a speech that Jacqueline Miller gave in Italy when there was a founding of a Lacanian school in Italy. Now, if people are from, this was done in 2000. So in 2000, Italian politics was going through some pretty interesting things, and we're still seeing, I think, the echoes of some of those things now with the rise of kind of like ultra-nationalism and ultra-nationalist parties in Italy and in Europe yeah. generally, right? There's been this kind of like major resurgence of a far right, which the far right is really, really interested in group identification. They love it. It's like one of their primary tools of engagement and recruitment for people, right? Join us. Because if you join us, you're not them. The bad ones, the slackers, the immigrant, the people who don't belong here, who haven't earned it, whatever it is, right? That's a huge thing which I see taking place on the right, and was taking place in Italy at the time. So Miller comes in, and they're trying to form this psychoanalytic school within the Lacanian tradition, and what he's trying to caution people against is having the school function in that same kind of a way. Where it's like join the school, join a group, and in joining the group, become part of this broader collective that kind of makes you part of us and not part of them. Because one of the things that makes a school different is that when you join a school, the school is not about necessarily belonging to a group. It's about highlighting the ways in which you're isolated. It's a weird thing. It's like the place where people come to be alone together, but they're ultimately alone. And it uses that isolation. It focuses upon this, right? It focuses on the singularity of the individual more so than the group identification. And what Miller talks about in the piece is interpreting the group effects that happen when you join a school, because it is a very seductive thing. It's extremely seductive to want to, for example, become part of a group that if you're part of this group, you're like a air quotes real analyst now because you're a part of this group. Mm-hmm. That would be one of those group effects that Miller is trying to say, like, if that's what you're doing, this is not what the school should do. The school shouldn't be about that. It should be about our subjective position in relation to an ideal. But our subjective relationship in relation to that ideal is always singular. And when we start doing things like saying things like, as psychoanalysts, we must, or if you were to say as Lacanians, we must, you've fallen victim to this propensity to identify more with the group. And when you start doing that, you're vulnerable to, I guess we could even call it like groupthink, right? And a good interpretation is something that Miller talks about. So he is encouraging people to join a school, but also to interpret the school and to interpret the effects of the school on people in real time. It's a really interesting thing. I can't think of anything else in any other that I know of in society, which kind of functions in the same way that the school functions in the way that Miller describes it in this piece and in the way that the school functions within the Lacanian community. I don't know if that actually answers your question though, Adam, does it?
Yeah, it does actually. I mean, I guess let me return a bit to Freud here to give you some of my thoughts on why I asked this question. I think what's really crucial to think about in terms of group psychology and the analysis of the ego is the influence of someone like Gustav Le Bon on Freud's thinking. And the whole like critique about like what you're describing as something like in Italy. I mean, we're talking about populism and the role of a charismatic leader to then organize a group of people around themselves and they become the ego ideal, right? That's the initial like inside of Freud is that there's a way. And I mean, I think it's also important to recognize too, that Freud's two main examples were the church and the army as like, you know, his sort of explanation or exploration, very provisional, I think, about here's how this seems to function. You know, I mean, in there, Freud does make some comments about, well, also like this identification, yes, like can like almost replicate the effects of like hypnosis on a large group of people. And yeah, and of course it can make them do things that they're not capable of as individuals, right? And that can be very horrible. he also does make some sort of offhanded comments about, but it also can be the things that push us to make incredible sacrifices and to push for abstract ideals like justice and equality. So to me, I think it's a complex description or exploration, I think, in Freud of what the role of like group psychology is. You know, is there a place to say that, you know, for someone like, let's say, like Berlusconi in Italy, or the rise of like, you know, far right populist leaders in the States and Hungary, you know, in Russia and wherever. Yeah, like, of course, I think those are effects. I just also think, for me, coming from a leftist, more radical revolutionary political position, it also seems that those very same risks create the conditions for people to collectively organize and be in solidarity together to fight those very same things. And to me, that's kind of the dialectical relation I want to keep with this whole approach, is to say, yeah, like, of course, there's a risk to it. And also at the same time, thinking about political engagement and involvement, it also seems like we have to be able to organize around those ideals too, despite the risks.
I think that's part of Malher's argument too, right? He's not arguing for us to get rid of ideals. If you read the piece, right? I think that's abundantly clear. Ideals are going to be created one way or the other. Mm-hmm. What I get out of what he's saying is the fact that we have to be very cautious around the ways in which those ideals are affecting us as individuals and as a group. And he's calling for an interpretation of that. This is where I think this happens everywhere, right? It happens in social work. We're all social workers, right? I think that we could take a look at the sort of like identification that a lot of people have with this thing called I'm a social worker. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times the way that I see that kind of play itself out is if you start to say things that are critical of the profession of social work, people start to kind of get mad at you. Why are you being so critical? Why are you being so negative? Why are you saying these things? You shouldn't say that. You know, that's you should join us. You're making us weaker if you are taking this rather critical stance in relation to what social work is doing. And I say that being told that on a regular basis by a large number of social workers, because I tend to take a pretty critical stance of the function that social workers are doing by and large in today's kind of like modern world. I think it's very different than the function that social workers played historically in the past. And that's kind of maybe a cul-de-sac we can go down if we want to. What Malher is saying is that's actually a really good thing. What we need to do is we need to consistently critique, right? Or what he would call interpret whatever group it is that we belong to. So if you belong to the school, if the school is like your jam, you have to be able to interpret the school. Mm-hmm. And this is the mistake that I see happening on the left and elsewhere, is that people find themselves concerned about what will happen if they interpret. Now, you can interpret and you can be wrong, and that's okay. You know, if you make an interpretation which is maybe done because you don't know something or whatever, all right, then you know the group can engage your interpretation and say like that's not correct for these reasons or whatever. But you can a lot of times if you land an interpretation, the effect of landing a good interpretation is that it makes people irritated, frustrated, angry, so on and so forth, because what you've done is you've exposed a truth which is a repressed truth. That's one of the things that interpretation does. Mm-hmm. Is it says it cuts away the repression, and the truth that is being repressed becomes somewhat more revealed. When you reveal a truth that is being repressed, you're revealing a truth that people want to keep hidden. You know, Lacan, in many of the things that he writes about, talks about our desire to not know things, mm-hmm. our desire to keep ourselves believing sort of a fictional version of ourselves and a fictional version of the things that are important to us as well.
Yeah.
And he thinks that that's a very strong desire to not know the truth about ourselves, the desire to not know the truth about whatever group we belong to, which is very important to us. And what Malher is talking about, you know, following Lacan, is the importance of consistently trying to bring up those truths so that they are not repressed. But if you do that, usually the effect is that people want you to, they say, leave the group. If you're going to be like that, just get out of here. We don't want you. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. And I see this happening again, a lot of places. I'm personally concerned with the ways that I see that happening on the left to social work. Lacan was talking about the way this happened within psychoanalysis when he was doing his work, right? Like, so, you know, the IPA was, had their training method that they were doing. And Lacan said this training method, you do it and you say you do it to guarantee the work of the analysts that you produce through it. He's like, but even if somebody goes through this training method, it doesn't necessarily guarantee that they're going to do anything good. It just means that they had the time and the money to do this training program. That's it. That's all it demonstrates. And the IPA was like, you can't say that. That's wrong. They didn't engage him in a debate about like the theoretical merits and flaws around what he was saying. They just went, you're wrong. Get out. And that's the problem that I think Miller is trying to say, like, let's not try to do what we can to not do that. Yeah, Jared, you haven't said anything for a little bit here, man. You're just kind of sitting back.
Yeah, I was
curious. I'm actually, you took it in a different direction than I was thinking of after Adam responded to you, because I was really interested in the, like, sort of, well, I guess you addressed it for a minute there, about how it's not, like, we don't have to completely cut away the idea of identifying with ideals, like, altogether. That's, I don't think that that's meant to be part of the project. So what I was thinking when Adam was talking is about how we decide that an idea, ideal is worthwhile for our investment, and then how we, like, prevent becoming so invested in it that it becomes a different project than what you intended for it to be in the first place. So that's what I was thinking of when Adam was talking. And then you touched on it a little bit, but then you had some other ideas as well that I hadn't thought of.
Yo, don't mind if I go ahead and take my round, since it might be a good sort of like building on this stuff. This is already covering a lot of what I was wanting to talk about anyway.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, it's interesting to think about this almost kind of like analytical framework, or like the idea of the school, right? That you're constantly interpreting the very thing you're a part of. It's really interesting because, you know, Lenin, before he died, actually proposed a particular structure that he hoped would be integrated into the early form of the, you know, the Soviet state, which was called the Triple C, the Central Command Committee. And the whole point of it was to have this sort of completely separate autonomous group that their whole role was just to critique everything that the state was doing, you know, and then unfortunately never came to pass because his death and then, you know, the rise of Stalin. But I do think that's something that Zizek speaks to, is like, there is this way that, you know, this is a persistent political problem. And so I think the risks and danger of this is really, it is really significant. And it's something that I think anyone engaged in any kind of politics, especially leftist politics, has to be really serious about, you know, the fact that what you think you're doing isn't really what you're doing. And the role of interpretation is key. But I kind of wanted to step back and kind of maybe get a little bit more personal to help me orient where y'all are coming into this conversation at, because I think it might be similar, but also different to me in some ways. So I also, since I'm kind of here, and I know we have this discussion on the Discords with a lot of people, I just want to say, like, the stuff that we're talking about today maybe doesn't, you know, include things about like the decolonial perspective and like some criticisms about psychoanalysis and stuff. So, you know, maybe that would be an interesting thing to explore, you know, at some other point. But for me, I was kind of like curious, because I've had this happen way too often. I wanted to just ask you both directly, who is this left that you speak of? Because that is a huge signifier. And I feel like everyone I've like organized with, good comrades of mine, use it in different ways. So whenever y'all like talk about that and feel like you're part of the left, like who, like how do you orient yourself towards that? Or like, what does that mean?
That is actually a great example, Adam, of an interpretation. What
yeah,
you just
I
did
know.
There.
So real psychoanalysis hours here today.
Right. Yeah. And that's exactly what Miller is. I mean, I want to answer the question, but also before I do say that what you're doing is what the kind of thing that Miller is encouraging people to do as part of a school. Right. So don't just take something and go like, okay, this person is saying like the left, the left, the left, and assume that you know what that means. Right. And you'll see a huge group of people probably going like nodding along or shaking their heads kind of in mass in response to whatever's being said, because they're involved in the group effect. And what you're doing is kind of trying to cut through that and say like, hey, there's a signifier being deployed here. What does it signify? That's actually a really good question, I think, right? So in an attempt to answer it, the way that I'm thinking about this is that, And it's weird because I didn't prepare for this kind of a question. So my answer is probably going to be lackluster and ill prepared. But I think a lot of times when I think of the right, what I imagine is a group of people and institutions that are collectively pooling their resources and through pooling those resources, attempting to use those resources to produce particular effects. One of the effects that they're attempting to reproduce is a return to a previous way of organizing ourselves as people in a society. And I think they're kind of trying to like reanimate things like a lot of times, like the signifier family values might be used, or make America great again, right? Like this idea that it was great before it became ungreat, but now we're going to reach into the past and sort of pull that past greatness into the present.
Well, even that slogan itself is a rehash of Ronald Reagan. So, you know, again, the bizarreness of the, I mean, for, you know, more revolutionary politics, we just call that good old reactionary ideals.
So what I think of is it happening there, though, is that, and this is what I was kind of trying to allude to earlier, the right attempts to kind of like massify that group effect to the highest possible degree, right? That there's in and there's out. They want very clear distinctions between the worthy and the unworthy. At least that's how I'm reading what they're doing here. I think that the left, this is a really simplistic answer to a very complicated question. I apologize for that. But I think that broadly on the left, what people are trying to do is a much more universalizing kind of politics where the right is very interested in particularity. The left, in the way that I'm using the word, is a group of people who are more interested in universalizing things like universal healthcare. When Martin Luther King was doing the activism that he was doing, civil rights was a universal concept. It was saying that all people should have civil rights, right? It was also calling attention to the fact that there was a particular group of people that lacked civil rights, but it wasn't saying that only that particular group of people should be the ones who gain them, or that they should gain them at the, and in them gaining them, somebody else would lose them. Right. That wasn't the argument that was being made. It was just saying, this isn't a pie where if you get a bigger piece, I get a smaller piece. It was saying we can all kind of like have our own pie in a way. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that makes sense, but that's a universalizing style here. It doesn't say that there's worthy and unworthy. It almost like assumes that by virtue of being a living speaking body that you have an almost like, I think, inherent worthiness for a variety of things. I think the left maybe has a harder time sometimes defending what happens when people don't respect universality, where on the right, when people don't respect particularity, they get punished. That's one of those differences, but that's kind of how I would see it, right? Like, I guess the right is a very particularist thing. If you meet these particular, demographics, if you've done these particular things, then you belong, you're part of us, you're in our gang, and we'll keep you safe because you're part of our gang from all the people who are not a part of that gang, because they want to get you. They want to take from you. They want to have things that are rightfully yours or whatever. And on the left, I think what you're seeing is a group of people who attempt to not do that, right? They attempt to instead say, we're all kind of in this together in a way. And so like, let's do this pooling our collective resources to the extent that we're able to do that. And in so doing, use them to kind of raise the water level for all people. That's at least my way of describing it. I'll let Jared say whatever Jared thinks.
I was going to describe something very similar, but in a different way. I was going to go more in a like policy focused direction than in a even more like zoomed out description of it. So I basically what I think of as being the left is generally someone who is opposed to capitalism in the way that it works now, at the very least. I there are people who I think of as leftists who want to do away with it 100%, and there are people who I think of as leftists that would like to like see it change somehow, to do something different with the resources that it already has. I would count both of those people as leftists. People I think of as leftists are also interested in, like Neil said, universal healthcare, sort of raising the water level for everybody, such that like you don't have to do anything to qualify for something like healthcare other than just be a person. So, those are two of the biggest things for me. Also, more generally, someone who is interested in social justice, like sort of broadly, things like institutionalized racism, patriarchy, issues like those things are who I think of as being leftists. So it's sort of pretty similar to what Neil said, but the direction that I was thinking of in was more like direct policy and issue type things, whereas Neil sort of zoomed it out a little bit more.
Yeah, that's actually really helpful to hear you all describe that. And it kind of helps me understand maybe sort of like maybe differences in like kind of interpretation or where we come down, like from let's say like kind of my perspective. So whenever I think about the left, it's interesting because I think a lot of times a really core debate in politics all across the standard left-right political spectrum is about the relationship between the universal and the particular, and or like group and individual identity or something like that. I actually see every political position actually as making some claim to a universal, and that in some way, like part of what political involvement and engagement with is sort of a struggle over who is going to define what the universal is. I think people who are very right-wing and conservative or even reactionary or fascist like have a claim to a universal idea. And in a lot of ways, like the functioning of the standard structures of power that exist now, like are establishing a kind of universal. This is the whole point of civil rights and like structural racism, is to say that, well, the whole point is that the universal is implicitly assumed as being white, cis, male, you know, middle class, upper middle class, all this other stuff. And so a lot of my understanding of social justice as a, you know, as a set of movements is about challenging that universal and redefining it in a new way. You know, just for me personally, you know, I, as a someone on the left, I think because they're all making every position is about some claim to what the universal is. You know, for me, being on the left is a very particular claim and a particular struggle over that universal. So, you know, my experience is coming not just from social work, which I, you know, just to state this pretty outrightly, I think politically tends to be what we typically call more liberal or even more quote unquote radical liberal, which is that we don't want to dismantle or destroy capitalism as the primary cause of all the main issues of social inequality. But it's like it has some externalities and some effects of inequality and discrimination. But if we fix those, it essentially, like the system's bedrock still continues. It's like, that's good. We don't need to challenge that. You know, I think my involvement on the left historically has been, you know, I've been that at times, but it's also, you know, I've organized in Marxist groups and anarchist groups. You know, I've been excluded. I've been canceled. You know, I feel like I'm a haggard veteran of the culture wars and the sort of terrible infighting in these leftist groups, which is exactly the things that, you know, Neil, you were talking about. It's pervasive and it's really, it's truly toxic. And it's really tragic to be involved in that stuff and to see, you know, our unconscious drives and jouissance like undermining everything we think that we're doing. And it tends to be very narcissistic and you know, yeah, like very self-defeating. So I guess kind of for me, I was curious just to hear y'all talk about that, because like in my experience being in a social work classroom, and I also, you know, teach social work students, not as a professor at the moment, but as a field instructor. And, you know, it's like, you do kind of see that. It's like, there is a way that anything that challenges the identity of the social worker as a profession is deeply, deeply threatening. And, you know, I kind of jerk around and say like, I'm a revolutionary leftist first and a social worker second. And I think part of the reason why I say that is because social work, you know, as an identity, as a particular identity that you can take on, tends to be contextualized in this political way. And I think, like to me shapes a lot of how I experience this idea of identification and what it means across, the political spectrum.
As you say that, Adam, I mean, the one thing that I really wanted to bring up here was the way that I see, the different people who I actually, this isn't theoretical, right? This is something that I live through. I come into contact with students. I come into contact with other activists, you know, who would describe themselves as leftists of various kinds of flavors maybe. And what I see them doing is engaging in what appears to me to be the hysterics discourse. And the four discourses are a Lacanian concept. They're very complicated. I think I'm not going to be able to explain them, but to give you just a quick overview of the Hysterics Discourse. In the Hysterics Discourse, the hysteric makes a demand to the master, to whoever, the social order, we could even say, right? It says, it basically goes, hey, you're doing something which is inappropriate. You're doing something which is hurtful. You're doing something which is wrong. You're doing something, and it could be done better. All of these would be examples of the kind of demand that a hysteric makes. And what they're asking the master, or the social order, to produce is a new form of knowledge or skills, maybe things that people do that will address the critique that the hysteric makes. And when the hysteric makes the critique, sometimes the master ignores that, right? No, you're wrong. We're not listening. Go away. But other times, the hysteric can make a critique, and if that critique is made, I guess, in a certain kind of way, a particular way, it might result in there being kind of a change. I think this is one of the things that we're seeing now, perhaps. I don't know if it'll continue to go this way, but for a while, what we're seeing is that as a result of movements like Me Too and Black Lives Matter, those are both great examples of the discourse of the hysteric, and they're making headway. They're creating actual change as a result of the demand that they're making. The thing that I see the left kind of getting stuck on is that I don't know that they want to exit out of the discourse of the hysteric and transform into a different configuration, one of the other three discourses. They seem to have a really hard time with that. And as a result, sometimes when positive, what I think of or recognize as positive change occurring, there are certain people on the left, more so than I think I see on the right, who will start to critique the change for not going far enough, or it's like, yes, you're doing this, but you're not doing it in a universal way, right? There's always this sort of like propensity to want to remain within that discourse. Sometimes I'm afraid that I'm doing that with my critique of the left right now is also a good example of a discourse of the hysteric. I'm making that critique, and I hope that what I'm doing is kind of trying to get the left to organize itself towards making substantial changes within the material conditions that people are contained within. I hope that if those changes occur, then that might mean that I transform into a different kind of discourse, which is less dependent on my making a critique and perhaps more contingent upon me kind of furthering the changes that are being made. I don't know if that would happen or not, right? I might be just as guilty as what I'm saying other people are guilty of, and I might want to remain in the discourse of the hysteric, but I hope not. That's kind of the point that I'm trying to make here. And this came up in relation to something that somebody on the Discord server said. They were, I don't remember who, but they were talking about organizing and psychoanalysis and organizing. And psychoanalysis is not a theory of how you should organize, like, you know, a group of people. Yeah. That's not what it was created for. Be that as it may, I think that there's some interesting concepts that you might be able to kind of like take from psychoanalysis and sort of like work into the different ways that you attempt to organize people. This is one of those things. These discourses is a great example, I think, of an idea here. And it's being able to understand what kind of discourse we're engaging in. And then also what part we're playing within the discourse. Because, you know, within each of the four discourses, there are kind of like four parts and four actors. And all that. I think this is a really important thing to consider. So that was my point that I really wanted to bring up.
Jared, do you want to say something? Because this is actually one of the points I wanted to talk through with y'all a little bit.
Say your piece, Adam. Go ahead.
Let me just say this too. This is one of the reasons why y'all are comrades, and I'm so happy we're getting to do this, because I love talking about this stuff, especially with people that are so steeped in psychoanalysis, because I do think the potential is there to apply these ideas in a really, really useful and necessary way. So the idea of the discourses to me is exactly, I think, a really key point to explore this. So let me think how to come at this. So let's talk about the discourse of this, Derek. And I think this is actually an interesting thing about what happens whenever psychoanalysis and those discourses and the way that they're understood, you know, in clinical work with someone moves from the clinic to the street, let's say. So my understanding of the discourses, as well as I can understand it and do at this point, is about the hysteric essentially feeling that the other is denying them their jouissance, or is like blocking it, or that they have the jouissance that they you know, feel that they want, or that someone else has that we don't. And I think that what's interesting in my understanding of Lacan's discourses is that you know, after May 1968, which is where his famous statement of, you know, as hysterics, as revolutionaries, you want a new master, you will have one, like came about in his engagement and his sort of back and forth with people who are, you know, part of Marxist-Leninist organizing groups who were, you know, maybe very supportive of communist China or the Soviet Union. And it was also a way to talk about what he called a sort of mutant form of the discourse of the master, which is the discourse of the capitalist. And I think what's most interesting is that, you know, does that discourse of the hysteric work in the same way in the clinic as it does talking to a bunch of, you know, like revolting students all across France? And I really don't know, honestly. I mean, I think that it can be something that's happening on the left. I just also think it can very easily be interpreted that anyone who is like making a demand or speaking truth to power, or talking about social inequality and oppression and exploitation, you know, maybe this the idea is like, is that always the discourse of the hysteric? And then what do we do to move out of that, especially if you want to be involved in leftist politics? Is it to move to the discourse of the analyst instead? I mean, you know, it's not an accident that Lacan's idea of what to do in response to capitalism, which I know you all have talked about in the first two episodes, is to invoke the figure of the saint. And to me, that's a really like important thing to grapple with. Like, if you operate on those ideas of the discourses, like, is that really where you're going to end up? Is this idea of like a sort of kind of saintly response, which, you know, is kind of, I mean, the best I understand it is almost like just kind of laughing at the sort of demands of capital to consume and enjoy. So anyway, I mean, this is a huge discussion, but to me, it's a really important point to focus in on. Yeah, like, how does the things in the clinic transfer to the street if you decide you want to be in one or the other or both, I guess.
That's really great when you say that. I guess I want to do something and I simultaneously do not want to do it when I respond to what Adam brought up here. But the reason I don't want to do it is I don't want to assume that people are super familiar with the discourses, but I kind of have to assume that in order to say what I would like to say here. So I apologize if you're not familiar with the discourses. Maybe Jared and I can do a series on the discourses sometime to try to, you know, get people more knowledge there. Yeah. But so there's these four sort of annotations in each of the discourses, S1, S2, barred subject, which looks like a dollar sign, and S with a vertical line bisecting it, and then a small letter A. So in the discourse of the master, which is like the sort of template, the first one, you have S1 makes a demand to S2 to produce A, and the repressed truth is the barred subject. One of the things that I've come to realize as I read Lacan, and in particular read the stuff that Lacan was producing very late in his career, is that S1 is always a semblant. It's always, always, always a semblant. What I mean by that is that it isn't, S1 is not the master. It is sort of like the master's agent, right? So to give you an example here, there's an army. The army has a general. The general could be seen as S1. S1, why does the general have the authority? Well, the people see the general as kind of like the embodiment of this larger system. They see the general as the agent of this symbolic order that they are a part of. But the general, him or herself, is not, you know, they only basically act as a stand-in for this other thing, right? That's always how they work. S2, a lot of times gets translated as like the slave or as knowledge. I tend to think of it as what people can do with knowledge. That's how I read S2, is it's skill, right? So if, you know, Adam, you're somebody who, actually I'll use Jared because I know this about you. Jared, you can read Spanish. You have a skill. I don't have that skill. If I was going to address you and address you as S2, I might hand you a text, which is in Spanish, and say, translate this. I'm not necessarily addressing you as Jared. I'm addressing your ability to translate, right? Your skill. And I could just as easily hand it to somebody else. Like Adam, if you also knew Spanish, I could hand it to you. If you were closer to me, I might do that, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's not like I'm handing it to Adam because I think Adam is better than Jared. I'm handing it to Adam because Adam has the same skill as Jared. And that's the discourse of the master. The stand-in for this larger way of being in the world. We could say an agent of capitalism, maybe, if we want to use like a dominant sort of thing here, says to a worker, use your skill to produce a thing that I want, ultimately, right? If you go into Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts or some other place that serves coffee, you walk up to the person at the counter, you say, can I please have like an Americano? Your S1, their S2, and you're asking them to produce A, which is the Americano, right? In that kind of a thing. So why am I bringing all this stuff up? I think a lot of times what I would really like to see happen is in the leftist groups that I'm a part of, is for people to have a better understanding of this, because I think that what the left is doing a lot of times is they're losing sight of the fact that people are semblance, and they're also losing sight of the fact that S2 represents something that you can do, a way that you can use knowledge ultimately. And I would kind of encourage people to look at them in that way. And I actually don't even remember why I'm saying this right now. I know it was in response to something that Adam brought up, and I don't remember anymore because I've just remembered on too much. So this is part of the thing here. So in the Hysterics discourse, the Hysteric addresses S1. I think a lot of times what's happening is that they're addressing S1. And I think in that discourse, people have a propensity to forget that S1 is just a fucking stand-in, right? It's not the system. It's just an agent of the system. And even if you take down S1, you do a scathing critique that just really makes whoever this S1 is look like a total tool.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually change the system, because the system just puts a new person in S1. They'll put somebody else there, right? That's the problem. And what the left is doing by engaging, I think, in the discourse of the Hysteric in the way that they are, is they're personalizing this. They're making these very personal attacks against the semblant in the place of S1. And this is a distraction because it prevents them from seeing the larger systemic problem that could be being addressed, which is a much more complicated, much more intensive thing to address. It's much more difficult to address that. It's a lot easier just to kind of go like, oh, this particular individual is just an idiot, so let's, or a sexist, or somebody who has done something which is really, really, really atrocious. Let's get them on that. Let's implicate them and get them. A ton of energy is going into these projects. And as a result, that energy isn't going towards other things. And I guess I see that as a problem. So hopefully that addresses something that was brought up earlier. And if it didn't, I'm sorry.
Jared, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, sure. So as you were talking before, Adam, I think that like a sort of reductive view on the question that you were asking is like, what's the step that you take after the discourse of the Hysteric? I think that was like the question implicit in saying.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, actually. I think that's a good catch.
Okay. All right. Cool. I'm glad I figured out what you were talking about. Sometimes I feel like I don't, but it's just because you're a smart guy who knows so much more stuff than I do. So anyway,
what Jared, I'm a bard subject too. I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Jared, you're the cat's meow man. You're the anchor of this podcast.
That's right.
Well, that's good to know too. Makes me feel a little bit better. So I think maybe part of what you were asking as well, and maybe not, so maybe now I'm actually putting words in your head that weren't there, is like, which discourse do we move into after the discourse of the Hysteric? So maybe that's what you meant. Maybe it's not. It's the way that I'm gonna answer my own question that I'm inserting into your head now. And I don't know necessarily that the aim is to go into any one of them in particular. I think there's a preliminary step, like in between those, that is the thing that Neil is trying to do right now, which is the interpretation of the group that is engaging in the discourse of the Hysteric in the way that it is right now. Maybe that moves you into another one of the discourses. Maybe it keeps you in the discourse of the Hysteric, but in a different way. I don't know. I think it probably depends. The point of any interpretation, I think, is to have an effect regardless of what that effect is. I mean, I think you hope that it is a good, in air quotes, a good effect. But either way, what you hope for is some sort of effect that it like decenters the person at whom the interpretation is leveled, or like sort of jostles them awake from some sort of like sedative state that they've been in, something like that. So I think that is the step that comes after. You recognize the way that people have been organizing, acting, talking, performing things, and you make some sort of interpretation of the way that people have been organizing, talking, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, anyway, that that's what Neil is trying to do here, mm-hmm. is make that interpretation and hope that it has an effect.
I think it's a really interesting thing to really touch on because, you know, my reading of Lacan, and at least what, you know, my understanding is that he didn't necessarily offer any of the discourses as like this solution to the mm-hmm. problem. You know, it's like even the discourse of the analyst is also like has its own kind of deadlocks or like unconscious right. sorts of thing. I mean, the idea is, I think ideally that's, you know, that's maybe in this sort of structure, right? Or the way that these operations happen, you know, maybe that one would give us the best chance of being able to cut through the sort of unconscious jouissance. And to me, that's another really important thing about a role that psychoanalysis can play. My understanding of the four discourses is that in every one, there's a particular way, especially in like the discourse of the hysteric or the discourse of the master, there's a kind of unconscious enjoyment that's operating that isn't being recognized as such. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously for the hysterics discourse, yeah, maybe you are getting that enjoyment out of like challenging power or, you know, that sort of protest, right? It can be that way. You know, and I think it's important to recognize that on the left, I see all sorts of different aspects of these discourses happening. A lot of times, you know, Lacan's initial critique of the USSR to the very same students who were like challenging him was to say that the USSR is operating in the, you know, the discourse of the university. Like it sees science, historical materialism, dialectical materialism as this discourse that's blocking this kind of recognition of the unconscious enjoyment. Like it isn't as objective as it thinks it is. It's still the master, right? And I think that I see a lot of people on the left who do this too. They step into the place of the master, not recognizing that them addressing us too, even as a semblant, is like full of their own unconscious enjoyment of stepping into that role of the authority and the master. People on the left do this all the time. And that's something I think does need to be critiqued. So I think there's a real value in that, to recognize how like we can be operating in these different positions in the discourses, and they can kind of show up all over the place. So yeah, I mean, I just think like it is a really valuable thing. And it's, I guess the thing I'm curious about is, you know, again, how does this shape how we think about ourselves? Like, you know, if you can recognize that, then, you know, does it mean that we're just going to sort of transition through these discourses? Maybe we should be in different discourses at different times, depending on what's going on. I mean, again, I don't know. I don't think it's super clear how this would translate, you know, from the clinic to the street. But it does seem like it's, again, at least helpful for that approach of checking certain unconscious operations that we're engaging in and the way that we're enjoying things in the exact opposite way that we think we are, I guess.
I think that makes sense. Jared used the word interpretation in what he was saying here. And I think that it might be somewhat productive to talk about what an interpretation is. Because it can mean a lot of things. Like when Adam said, you know, what is the left? So I'll kind of say, you know, what is an interpretation? And lately, I mean, my thinking on this changes somewhat regularly, but there's sort of two ways I'm thinking of it now a lot. The first way is that an interpretation is a way of talking about that unconscious, repressed truth that exists, you know, that people kind of have a desire to not know. That's the function of an interpretation, is to make that somewhat known, right? The other way that I can think of as an interpretation is more about like, well, okay, how does one do that exactly, right? If that's something that you want to, if that's an effect you want to have, how do you have that effect? And, I think I would say that an interpretation is when an analyst or a person says something which is true and it kind of gets recognized as such. And they do it by saying something that has not yet been said. And I give this example sometimes when I teach in social work classes. One of the sort of like aphorisms in the field of social work now, and it's been around for a long time, is meet the client where the client's at. I'm sure you've both heard that or maybe even said that. I've heard and said it at different times in my own career.
Also guilty of both.
You know, so that I was saying that because somebody said that to me, and they were probably saying it because somebody said it to them. Well, at a certain point, somebody said to me, how do you know where the client's at? All right. That's an interpretation. It's somewhat provocative. It's something that I haven't said that. I haven't thought that. And it's not a crazy thing. It doesn't take a lot of like conceptual gymnastics to understand what's been said there. You can get it. But what it does is it arrests the sort of like repetitive nature of the discourse that I'm in, right? And that, I think when that repetitive nature of the discourse, the feedback mechanism gets kind of like interrupted through interpretation, one of the things that can happen is a shift in either what position you're in the discourse, or you can shift into a new discourse. And that's the idea here. So to go almost way back to what we were talking about earlier in this episode, Miller talks about this in relation to the school. He thinks that we should interpret the school, and in so doing, kind of like say things about what the school is doing and the effects that the school is having. And if you don't want to say school, the group, the union, the whatever you want to call it, is having on us, that kind of naming something and naming it accurately, naming it well, and in so doing, kind of changing the ways in which people are sort of the flows of their enjoyment are have been flowing in a really unrecognized, unconscious kind of fashion. I think that's a really important thing to do.
This actually leads me to another thing I wanted to ask you all about. So from, I think, especially the second episode that y'all did, you were talking about that, you know, is psychoanalysis like revolutionary with, you know, capital R, or is it quote unquote revolutionary, right? To like bracket it and say it might appear as such, but maybe it's really not. And kind of on this note, you know, talking about that process of interpretation, you know, I could see that happening, at least hypothetically. It could happen in any group. You could have that happen in your church group. You could have that happen, yeah, in your union meeting. You could have it happen in your, you know, weird fringe Maoist sect. And it also seems like y'all were kind of saying that, like, it can be revolutionary, but it isn't necessarily so. And if that's the case, I'm kind of curious, like, what do you think does need to be sort of added, or what else does one need to engage in or sort of consider for psychoanalysis to potentially be revolutionary to the extent that it can?
Sure. That's a good question that I'm only going to have a terrible answer for.
Listen, unless you answer it perfectly, we're not going to be comrades and friends anymore.
I'm fucked then, aren't I? It was good to know you, Adam, I guess.
Peace out, y'all. It's been fun. It's been real.
End of episode. I guess my first thought is that you can probably attach psychoanalysis to your revolutionary project in a whole bunch of different ways. I think the way that, say, an anarchist could apply psychoanalysis to their psychoanalysis to the way that they think about politics is maybe different from the way that someone who identifies as like a Marxist-Leninist could use it, or someone who identifies as some other identification that you can make. I think that that's part of why it has like a revolutionary potential, but isn't itself, is because you can, I mean, it's an analysis, right? It's a way of applying, like interpretations and listening and, I already said interpreting. It's a way of applying those things, and those things can all be applied in different ways to the same issue. I think that that's something that becomes pretty clear as soon as you start listening to people talk about psychoanalysis and politics. I mean, the way that Todd McGowan thinks about psychoanalysis and politics, other people think is fucking stupid. There are a couple of people I know who just hate the way that he talks and thinks about psychoanalysis as it relates to politics. I think it's really stupid and that it could be done better. So I guess the way that I'm answering your question is the worst way possible is to say that it depends.
Work answer. It depends.
It depends. Everything depends all the time. You can't ever answer a question straightforward. That's my response anyway, is that it's so malleable, and it's malleable on like by design almost.
So to chime in on this, and God, I don't know if this is going to work here. I'm fighting to think a little bit here, because my kid had a rough night and he woke me up like three times and everything. So I'm groggy. Sorry about that. And I'm stalling. Let's stop doing that. I think that the most revolutionary I frequently say when I teach about psychoanalysis that I believe that psychoanalysis is the most revolutionary form of psychotherapy that exists. And I do. I absolutely believe that. Maybe one day I won't believe it, but today I do.
And despite everything I said that might sound to the contrary, I agree with that. Anyway, continue. Sorry.
Yeah, no worries. The reason I believe that it is that it doesn't make demands. It doesn't do it. It doesn't say, you must, you have to, you'd better, try this, here's a coping skill. It doesn't offer prescriptions. It doesn't tell people what to do. It doesn't tell them how to do it. It does not do those things. It tries to sometimes implicate them in the things that they are doing by describing those things in a way that the person that make kind of like forces a bit of a recognition. But that's it, right? It doesn't mean that the person will stop doing that once they recognize that that's what they're doing. They may choose to even do it more. They could choose to do it less. They could choose to do it about the same amount that they're doing it currently. You can point out to somebody that that they're taking a risk riding a motorcycle. They can still ride the motorcycle. You know, it's not inaccurate to say that they're taking a risk, probably a greater risk riding a motorcycle than driving in a car. They can still do it. I think that this is revolutionary. I think it's revolutionary. And this is what the discourse of the analyst is that it is listening to what is happening, what is being said, how it's being said, and then interpreting what you hear when there's a good moment to do that. And if you don't have anything to interpret, you know what you do? You don't say anything. You just wait. You just listen. And eventually somebody says something that matters, that you can interpret, and that's when you do. I think that this is a revolutionary practice. I think it's different than what I see at a lot of different kind of like leftist functions where there's a bunch of people who want to kind of like, you know, stand up, get the microphone or whatever, and, you know, kind of perform just how smart they are, perform how woke they are, maybe perform how revolutionary they are, whatever that means. They want to show people, right? I don't think that that's as revolutionary as sitting and being patient and listening. And when you have something to say about what is happening around you, saying it. And when you do this, by the way, this is the other part that I think makes it revolutionary. A good interpretation is going to be revealing that hidden truth. It's not going to necessarily mean that people are going to think that you're the most wonderful, fun person to be around. A lot of times they're not going to like what you have to say. And they're not going to like it because what you're saying is, in fact, revealing something that they desire to not know. I think you need courage to do this. And I think that that is a courageous and revolutionary thing to do. I can't necessarily apply it to every single situation, but that's the crux, I would say, of my belief.
I mean, hearing you all describe it that way, I almost get the sense that the revolutionary potential of psychoanalysis is sort of like a kind of, I don't know if I want to say like an orientation, a position, a set of like, kind of like a subjective practice that you engage in with other people. And it is designed to sort of cut through and reveal that hidden truth, the thing that no one is able to like recognize or is repressing and doesn't want to recognize and acknowledge. Would you say that's kind of how you think about it?
Yeah, I think so. That's one.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
So I guess like to me, like the kind of interesting thing is to say, okay, like again, you know, how like does that inherently lead to a larger like social kind of vision of what revolutionary is? Because I mean, you know, I think you kind of mentioned maybe on the second episode that for you, like some like that you learn more about what like emancipation is or what is revolutionary from psychoanalysis more than anything else. And so I think kind of hearing you describe it that way, it makes sense. It's like, yeah, it's like this kind of like thing that reduces repression or the thing that can sort of diminish the amount that we are repressing things. I guess I would sort of wonder about, again, the sort of move to a larger collective kind of idea. Like, you know, does that mean the same thing when you think about like a collective vision of what revolution is? And maybe it's that's kind of like the domain shift and like where the real questions lie.
So in specific response to that, what I want to say, and this is again, I'm going to be critical of the left here, and I don't want to make it sound like the left is the only entity or group of entities that are doing this. I think a lot of entities do this, but I'm more concerned about how it happens on the left. So that's why I'm taking the time to critique it in this way. One of the things that happens, I think, in various sorts of like revolutionary sects or ideologies, maybe, groups of people that kind of come together in various ways, is that there is this demand that gets, and this is the hysterics discourse, there's this demand that we have to change things. We have to change them in this way. We have to, I'm going to really pick on the ISO here because I think they're one of the easiest things to pick on. It's low hanging fruit.
But they please.
You know, they had this highly doctrinal way of saying, like, this is how you have to go through this like program of learning how to kind of like be a good Marxist, you know, and it's, you read this, you do this, you don't say that. If you do say that, or you think that, don't do it. So on and so forth. You have to organize. And I think, it's interesting because some of the things that they were saying probably would have worked really well in a different time period, but I don't know that they were necessarily very well situated for the current time period and all that, but they were stuck in, I would say they were stuck in doing it in an old way that never really got updated for sort of like a new world. Anyways, the point that I'm making here is that things like obedience and compliance can absolutely be coerced. They can be. It's not that hard. You can say, do this, and if you don't do it, this bad thing will happen to you. And by and large, if the bad thing is significant enough, people will do the thing that you're telling them that they should do, or they'll refrain from doing the thing that you're telling them to refrain from doing. There, I've seen many instances in my career as a social worker where when somebody's on probation and they're getting drug tested, they won't use drugs because they're going to get drug tested and they don't want to go to jail. So, okay, I'll stop using drugs while I'm on probation. They get off probation. You know what happens? They start using drugs. Now, whether that's good or bad or doesn't even matter, that's what happens, right? That's a great example of coercing a compliance with a norm, right? Through this thing. If you do this thing that is non-normative, then you'll have to deal with the consequences of going to jail. You don't want to go to jail. You'll conform with the norm. This is not revolutionary in my mind. The way that psychoanalysis works is not by attempting to coerce people into complying or being obedient with anything. It consistently asks people, what do you want? What do you want? What do you want? Why do you want it? You know, that's all that it's doing. And this removes the standard way that people react to things. One way that people react to things, one standard is by complying with it. Another standard is by rebelling against it. If psychoanalysis does not make a demand, there's nothing to comply with nor rebel against. And it forces the subject to determine for themselves what it is that they desire. I think that that's revolutionary. I think it's hard. I think it's messy. I don't think it's organized at all. But I think that it is revolutionary.
You actually lead me to maybe the last big thing I wanted to talk about, which is exactly this point. And it's the particular way I think that y'all have talked about the way that drive functions, especially in the left. And I agree, you know, we critique the left most intensely because we love them. And that's our people. But I think this is a really crucial question is, you know, the way that demand is sort of operating a lot of the time in like things that we'll call like leftist politics. And, you know, the way that y'all talk about demand and desire and drive, it seems like the point is to sort of disempower the drive so the demand can shift to a desire. Like, what do you want, right? And I think like the most interesting question for me to explore is to say, once you can, you know, again, cut through that enjoyment, disempower the drive, how possible is it? And maybe this is Lacan's, you know, structure of desire that isn't about the content, but how possible is it to genuinely desire a revolutionary sort of movement? As the thing that isn't about a demand, but is the thing that you truly desire. And you know, what happens then? Because that to me is I think the thing I'm interested to explore after, you know, again, once you can maybe recognize the way that demand and drive are functioning, you know, sort of what, just kind of the space that maybe could open up for something like that.
I don't know if I get the question here. So like, could you say it one more time? Because I think
yeah.
I get what you're talking about. I get the terms. I think I just, mm-hmm. I'm not sure that I understand what it is that you're asking.
Well, I guess like this is the kind of the thing about psychoanalysis for me as it relates to politics. If the idea is to sort of cut through and to interpret and to disempower the drive, like it is in your sort of kind of thinking about psychoanalysis and politics, can someone genuinely desire revolution without necessarily seeing it as being about, again, like kind of the operations of like demand or like the hysterics discourse?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the thing, though, and this is maybe kind of my previous critique of the ISO comes to mind here, right? Like, the idea that the revolution is some sort of static entity is in my mind, incorrect, right? The revolution is a process. Utopia is a process. It is not an end. Mm-hmm. You know, and I would say that one of the lessons of psychoanalysis is that as soon as you get to the end, well, that's not where you want to be. You know, you want something better, usually, than what you currently have. And I mean, this is, I don't know, maybe this is my sort of like, I don't know how good this is. It's my read on Hegel, right? I think that one of the things that Hegel is getting at is that, you know, you're on this path to get somewhere. And if you actually arrive at the place, you realize that all of the important stuff happened on the path. It didn't happen once you were there. You can't, and it was about the path the whole time. When you were outside trying to get in, that's when you were actually inside, right? And that, I think that's a very frustrating thing for me sometimes to think about, because it is a frustrating thing, but it seems like a true thing to me too.
Yeah.
And I guess like that's the idea here. We, whoever we are, right? Whatever that means, we could try to create something which would be called a revolution. And we might even be successful at some point in doing that, pulling that off. And that would be interesting. And it would either be horrible or great. I don't know which, but something would happen.
Probably both.
Yeah. And, you know, then what would happen is the desire slides, right? It'll always slide to the next. And that's what life is. Life is the perpetual sliding of desires. This is objet, right? You get something, you want something else, and you keep on going. You know, Lacan pointed out that people feel oftentimes like they're sort of like tortured by their desire. Like they're tortured by the consistent like sliding of desire from one thing or experience or knowledge to the next thing. And they're like, oh, why can't I just like be satisfied? Well, that's the drive. The drive is if you were just satisfied, like truly satisfied, you don't need anything else. That would be being dead. That would be a return to the place before you were born, when there was nothing frustrating you, when there was nothing you wanted, because there was nothing to want, right? That's the drive. Desire is in opposition to the drive, because it's saying that there will always be something else in addition to, you know, whatever you have now. That's life. And so when I talk about, you know, disempowering the drive and kind of like fanning the flames of desire, that's what I mean here. I think that what I want to do is encourage people to live. To live is to engage in a collection, a constellation of things and stuff that are sometimes nice and sometimes not, that are sometimes satisfying and other times frustrating, that are interesting and boring. This is what it means to be alive. And I think that being alive is better than being dead. And so I want to extend that. I want there to be life. And even after my life comes to an end, I hope that life continues. And I guess that's a universal as far as I see it too, right? That's a potentially revolutionary universal. And that's what I see psychoanalysis kind of working towards.
The only thing that I have to add to Neil's very, I don't know the right word, cool speech, I guess, for to use a shitty word. The only thing that I would add is that it's a quote from Lacan that I think about a lot, all the time. It haunts me pretty consistently. He says, desire is cut of demand. The way that I think about that is that, like, desire is sort of like born from demand. The demand is first, and the desire is like cut from the cloth of demand. So I don't know for sure that they can be like completely separated. I think there's probably always going to be some sort of overlap in that, in the Venn diagram of desire and demand. I think it ceases to be desire if it doesn't have any aspect of demand to it. Mm-hmm. So that's the other thing that I would add to Neil's response to your question there.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate the thoughts. I think that whenever I kind of throw around the Sick and Fire revolution, you know, we're very much in agreement on this, that the idea that the like the quote unquote revolution with a capital T, capital R trademark ever was successful is just ahistorical and is, as my Zadi Zizek would say, pure ideology. Because in a way, I think that this is what has to be grappled with. And this is what I find I appreciate most about McGowan and his interpretations of Hegel is that, you know, contradiction never ends. Like the idea that anything that offers you the idea of a resolution of contradiction fully and finally is inherently sort of, you know, it's an ideology of closure, an ideology of stasis and death. Just to put it really kind of bluntly. And I'm very much in line with McGowan about this. So I guess, you know, the real thing is who gets to fill in the container of the signifier we call revolution? And what does that mean? And how are we collectively defining that together? Because the thing that I think I encounter most in my history of organizing, you know, on the left and then thinking about this stuff and really committing my life to it, you know, kind of very passionately, is that more often than not, no one talks about like what we fill into that word. And it stands in for everything. It stands in for this thing that we think is going to solve all the problems. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why I love Frederick Jameson's essay, An American Utopia, because he basically, I think, is doing this exact thing, is to say, actually, you know, I think whenever you talk about revolution that way, you're just like completely wrong. And you haven't even really like thought through what it would mean to even like materially and concretely bring something like that about. And so I guess to me that kind of leaves me with the ultimate question is, yeah, like what does that word mean? And then, you know, what can psychoanalysis teach us about how we or like potentially organize our whole identity around that word and the sort of weird, unconscious jouissance that we wrap up in it. I guess like kind of me in my own process, the more I kind of try to be really critical of that and like think about it and, you know, like, read this stuff and study it. It's almost, to me, it fans the flame of my desire for it even more, I guess is what I would say.
That's an interesting read because I think it makes me a consistent or not consistent, a concise way of saying what I think, you know, reading McGowan has helped me realize something, right? That on the side of desire, you have contradiction. Mm-hmm. That's what it is, right? It's the desire to resolve contradiction, but you have to have contradiction in order to have the desire to resolve it, right? You have to be alive in order to, like, do anything. And, yep. And, on the side of the drive, you have non-contradiction. Right. And so the idea here is to the extent that we can like disempower non-contradiction and empower contradiction, we encourage people to live. And again, I guess that's like a revolutionary idea to me. It's not prescriptive. It isn't a program of revolution, right? It's just saying like, we should do this makes more sense. And it seems again to be a pretty universal thing. So that's one of the other things that makes it really interesting and revolutionary and cool to me.
It makes me think of maybe this is a total tangent and it won't make sense to anybody except for me when I say it. So I really like the Star Wars movies, right? And recently I happened to watch a critique of The Last Jedi. And somebody goes through, it's like a really long video. I don't know how I managed to watch this whole 5-hour long critique of the fucking The Last Jedi. It was, or the, yeah, whatever. Anyway, so the point of the video is that this person goes through and almost line by line points out every single plot hole that he sees in this movie. And, you know, there are a lot of them. But as I'm watching for 5 goddamn hours, Jesus, that makes me sound even more of a lunatic than I am.
You're in good company. I have also watched that. Just so you know.
Oh, there you go. Okay. All right. So then that helps me feel a little bit better about it. But so he's going through line by line, pointing out every single plot hole. And like the whole time I'm watching, I'm thinking like, if this was a perfectly well put together, like zero plot holes whatsoever, there's nothing at all to critique at all. There's no problems. There's no contradictions. There's no nothing. That would be like the worst movie I can possibly think of watching. I can't think of a worse movie than to watch like paint drying on a wall. Like there's no contradictions there. There's no inconsistencies. There's no like human element to a story that doesn't have any flaws or any contradictions or anything else to it whatsoever. So I don't know. Maybe that is not related to everything that you just said, Neil, but it's what came to mind.
That's funny. It makes me think that Bellatar should make the next Star Wars movie. You know, slow
I would
cinema.
Watch it.
I would too. A long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, somebody just like sits on Tatooine and like, I don't know, sees clouds move. There you go.
Yeah.
The next Star Wars movie.
Sign me up. It'll be better than The Force Awakens and whatever the last one was, The Rise of Skywalker.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Very, very interesting. All right. You know, so we've been talking for just under an hour and a half here. I think that we kind of have said a lot of interesting things. So maybe this is a good wrapping point. I want to say thanks to both of you. Thank you, Jared, for being the Cat's Meow and being here. Adam, thanks for being the Dwayne The Rock Johnson of the left podcasting world and for gracing us with your presence and for asking
the
great questions.
I'm doing the eyebrow. I'm doing the eyebrow thing right
the,
now.
The people's
no
eyebrow.
One can see it. Yeah. Yeah, the people's eyebrow.
Later on, he's going to do the people's elbow to me because I disagree with his revolutionary politics.
Hey, listen, that's fanning our desire. We're keeping the contradictions open.
There we go. There we go. Yeah, so this has been fun. Hopefully people who listened to it, you also enjoyed it. I don't know what Jared and I have next on our menu. We have a bunch of different ideas that we're thinking we're going to explore. And we'll probably talk about which one is next, but I do think that the next episode is probably going to not be like this is a series, really kind of like three in a row about sort of the same thing. My guess is that our next episode, possibly our next two episodes, are going to be more like standalone-y kinds of things. And then maybe later on we'll kick off another series again. But thank you everybody for taking the time to download and listen to the Informed Podcast. Thanks to the guests again for being here.
You guys have
any takeaways?
I just feel like this is an ongoing conversation. And so it's kind of cool to get like this snapshot of like an active ongoing conversation. I always love hanging out with y'all and talking with y'all. So I'm, you know, just onward and upward into more of the same.
How about you, Jared?
I'm still absorbing. I'm not going to give any last words if I haven't even finished the process here.
We haven't said anything worth interpreting. That's what's going on. That's what Jared just told us. All right. On that note, you know, everybody, take care, make glorious mistakes, and listen to us the next time that we produce an episode.